If you know Randy Fox, you know that he is a walking, talking history lesson who loves music, movies, history, and radio, and loves writing and talking about music and movies and history and radio. Randy started his well-known Nashville radio show of classic country music, the Hip Billy Jamboree, about 25 years ago on WRVU, which was Vanderbilt University's student-run radio station. He's written for a bunch of publications, including Vintage Rock, Country Music, Record Collector, Journal of Country Music, and the Nashville Scene. And he's the managing editor of the Madisonian and editor-at-large for the East Nashvillian, two magazines that feature great writing and the interesting stories of people from another side of Nashville. In 2012, Randy, along with six other dedicated volunteers, did everything necessary to secure an FCC license and launch WXNA-FM, a low-power, high-voltage, listener-supported, free-form community radio station. And everything necessary is a lot. Mountains of paperwork to secure the license, tower location, and the construction permits. Locating and paying for all the transmitter gear and the antenna, finding and renting a space for both the transmitter and then the actual station, where the DJs are, designing and outfitting the studio with board, mic, soundproofing. Then there's all the fundraising you need to do to make all of that happen. So, yeah, it's a lot, and we are so thankful that they did it. You grew up in Muhlenberg County, Kentucky.
That's correct.
Very famous county in Kentucky. Well, what brought you to Nashville?
Well, I went to school at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green, and I majored in journalism. And by the time I got out of school, I really didn't become a music fanatic until I entered college, because growing up in Muhlenberg County, I always like to say that, you know, for some reason, Sex Pistols and Clash Records didn't end up at the Uncle Lee's or the Big K in Powderly, Kentucky, for some reason. I don't know why exactly, but, you know, they didn't end up there. Plenty of Lynyrd Skynyrd in Alabama, but not much of that. Anyway, so my freshman year of college, I discovered music and just went nuts. And so by the time I was done with my 4 years of college and I had my degree in journalism, I pretty much knew that I wanted to write about music or popular culture or so forth. So it just kind of made sense to try to come to Nashville at that point. And this was in August of 1986. And at that time, I was kind of keeping up with what was going on in Nashville. I'd become a huge fan of Jason and the Scorchers and some of the other bands that were starting to get signed at that time. Whenever I'd come down here, I would always go to Cats on West End and The Great Escape and Discount Records on Elliston Place and so forth. So when I moved down here in August 86, I was like, oh, Nashville's about to break loose as the rock and roll town. And I'll, you know, this will be the perfect place to write about rock and roll in Nashville. And which, you know, I like to say I was correct, but I was like 32 years too soon. So
how did you discover, you said you discovered music in college. How?
Well, as I said, whenever I started college, most of that's what I heard on the radio in the late 80s was mainstream, you know, top 40 stuff. And a lot of it, you know, at that point, it was like, I remember REO Speedwagon's High Infidelity being the biggest album of my senior year in high school, which was a record I just absolutely hated. And at the time, I was not very much into music at all. I liked the Beatles, and I was a big movie nut. So I collected soundtrack LPs, which is like, that's how square I was in high school, is that I was into soundtrack LPs. Funny enough, I discovered the Ramones by the most roundabout, nerdy way you could possibly discover the Ramones. And that was in 1980. Like I said, I was a big movie nut, and I would religiously watch Siskel and Ebert's show, Sneak Previews, on PBS every single week. And since it was on PBS and I could get more than one PBS station, it would actually be on, I think, three or four times during the week. So I'd watch it every time it was on. And they did a show in, I believe, 80 or 81, on cult movies, where they profiled Rocky Horror Picture Show, Dawn of the Dead, and Rock and Roll High School. And that was the first place I ever heard about the Ramones. And I was just like, holy crap, who is this band? This looks cool. This is not REO Speedwagon. This looks really cool. But again, there were no Ramones records to be found in Muhlenberg County, Kentucky. And my first 2 or 3 weeks of college in the fall of 1981, two events happened. One, I made friends with a guy who was across the hall from me, who was really into music. And we were talking, and I was over at his room and we're talking about music. And for some reason he brings up the Sex Pistols. And I'm like, oh, that's that awful band from England that made a bunch of news when they came here several years ago or something, isn't it? And he's like, holy shit, you've never heard the Sex Pistols. You've got to go buy that record right now, right now. So I drove out to the mall and bought Never Mind the Bollocks, the Sex Pistols, brought it back to my dorm room and put it on. It was like, oh, you know, it was just amazing. And almost at the same time, they would have this thing at the college bookstore with that they'd call a record sale. And all it was is they'd bring in a bunch of budget and discount and cheap import records and throw them out. And they'd be like $4.99, $5.99, something like that. So I walk into the college bookstore and I'm flipping through all these cheap records. And there's a copy, a Portuguese import of the Ramones' It's Alive. And I'm like, oh, holy shit, this is that band that was on Siskel and Ebert, you know. So in the space of about 2 to 3 weeks, I got the first Sex Pistols album and I got my first Ramones album. And that changed everything for me.
And when you first got to Nashville, you came here looking for a journalism job to write about music. And were you able to do that?
No, I pretty quickly found out that no, I didn't have the experience. And also I was wanting to write about rock and roll. And about the only place I could do that was for fanzines. And I didn't have enough clips about writing about music. So I thought, well, okay, I'll just start freelancing and see what I can do. So almost as soon as I hit town, I just called up the Metro and went in there and said, hey, I want to write for you. And they said, well, why don't you do some live reviews and let us see what those look like. So I started writing live reviews for the Metro. I'd eventually make my first actual sale to Goldmine magazine. I published a piece in 87, I believe it was, on Jason and the Scorchers, and did some more pieces for them. And then over the years, just kind of parlayed it into freelance. I've never actually had a full-time employment as a writer. I freelanced for years on the side and had a mainstream job. Eventually, I did get a job writing, but I was corporate writing. I was a marketing writer for Jack Daniels for several years. And then whenever they laid me off, I ended up just becoming full-time freelance. And that's what I've been doing for the last, 11 years now. I want to tell you about a dance that's going around. Everybody doing it, from the grown-ups down. We have to move your head, we have to move your hands, we have to move your lips, just shake your hips. And do the hip shake.
In between his freelance writing gigs and his work at WXNA, Randy also wrote the book Shake Your Hips, The Accello Record Story, about one of the most influential American blues, soul, and gospel record labels based here in Nashville. And because the history of Nashville labels like Accello is so intertwined with the history of the popular radio stations and record stores of the time, like Buckley's Discount Record Shop, Randy made a really interesting discovery. In a 2019 social media post, he wrote, quote, "That moment when the history nerdgasm reaches maximum intensity. I've been researching the history of Buckley's Record Shop. For 45 years, Buckley's was the largest record retailer in Nashville. Ernie's Record Mart had a bigger mail order business, but Buckley's had the largest retail stores. Between 1953 and 1976, Buckley's primary store was located at 1707 Church Street. 16 years after Buckley's closed its doors, Lucy's Record Shop opened in the exact same location, and I've never heard any mention of the fact. I'm so excited," end quote. He wasn't the only one. On the surface, this is a too-cool-for-school nugget of information, history repeating itself in the most awesome way. Looking at the pictures of Buckley's on Church Street from the 1960s, You can see racks of vinyl and show posters illuminated by the sun shining in through the giant windows in the front. It's all so eerily familiar. But dig a little deeper, like Randy did for his book, and you learn that the story of Buckley's is also the story of two other record stores, as well as the story of jukeboxes in Nashville, the explosive popularity of some DJs who were willing to play records that no one else would play, a world-renowned mail-order business, a violent tragedy, and the racist policies of late mid-20th century urban planning.
Well, I'll try to give you the short background on this.
No, possible. Don't give me short. Give me long. Too long.
Okay. In the early 90s, I started working at, I was working as a bank teller on Nolensville Road, and I'd been going into Phonolux Records for years, which was just a block down the street from where I worked at the bank. And because I was working at the bank and I was in there all the time and I knew the people that worked there, they offered me a job just working part-time, like after I got off at the bank, because we'd close around 4:30 or something until they closed. So I started working at Phonolux. And while I was at Phonolux, I met a guy named Michael Gray, who, when I first met him, he was a senior in high school. And through him and also through other people at Phonolux, I really started getting into a lot of early roots music, 40s and 50s R&B, early rock and roll, rockabilly, that kind of stuff. And Michael had a lot of interest in Nashville's R&B scene from the 1950s. So while I was still working at Phonolux, I remember Dan Cooper wrote a story in the Nashville scene about the R&B scene in Nashville in the 1950s, which was the first place I really got a hard facts on that. Well, fast forward, Michael would eventually end up becoming one of the curators at the Country Music Hall of Fame, which he is today. And him and Dan Cooper would organize this exhibit called Night Train to Nashville, which was one of the first things that really focuses the attention on the massive R&B and soul scene that Nashville had in the 40s, 50s, and 60s that most people had forgotten about, you know, or had no knowledge at all. One of the things that came out of that was there was a label called Nashville Records and Accello Records that was started by a store downtown called Ernie's Record Mark. It was on 3rd Avenue. And a few years ago, I had a chance to write a book.
And the name of it is?
Shake Your Hips, The Accello Records Story. And it's just a history of this really fascinating R&B and black gospel label that was run out of this record store, whose primary business was selling records through the mail. Well, the reason that it became selling records through the mail was because in the around 1946, WIC, which was the other Clear Channel station in town, people always talk about WSM and the Grand Ole Opry being a 50,000-watt Clear Channel AM station, but WLAC, Nashville actually had two Clear Channel stations, and WLAC was the other one. And what Clear Channel means for people that don't know about AM radio or the history of it now, there were certain frequencies designated on the dial by the FCC early on for AM stations as Clear Channel stations, and that was because that AM travels much further than FM signal does, especially at night. Once the sun goes down and you're not getting an interference from the sun, AM signals will actually bounce off the stratosphere and go great distances. So a 50,000-watt station located in a centrally located place like Nashville, you had a signal that would reach all the way up into Canada, all the way south down into the Bahamas and the Caribbean, as far west as at least as, you know, almost to the Rocky Mountains. And really on some freakish nights, they could even pick it up in California. And certainly blanket the entire East Coast. So the fact that Nashville had two of these stations was pretty significant. Well, that's part of the reason that the Grand Ole Opry became a big deal, was because basically people could hear it over half of the country whenever it would broadcast on Saturday nights. Well, starting in 1946, WLAC hit upon the idea of starting to broadcast, play rhythm and blues records at midnight.
Why did they decide to do that at night?
Well, the story goes is that the nighttime DJ at WLAC at this time was a guy named Gene Nobles, who was a real character. He was one of the classic motor mouth, mile a minute DJs. And he tended to play pop music and swing records and a little bit of jazz. You know, it was just kind of the standard fare. Well, the story is that in 1946, a group of Fisk University students, who were big fans of Gene Nobles, came to the station and said, "Hey, would you mind starting to play some of our music on the radio? We like the jazz and the swing you're playing, but we'd really love to hear you play some of these records." And what it was, what they were talking about was R&B, which was more jump blues, the more African-American music that appealed more to that market and wasn't kind of watered down a little bit to appeal to a mass market. And Gene was open to the idea. He said, sure. So he started playing these records. Well, there was a little bit of controversy at first, of course, because suddenly this very black music was being played on WLAC at night. And some people in Nashville naturally had an objection to that. But what WLAC noticed was they were getting tons of calls and letters from people who really dug what they were doing. And this was a trend that was starting to happen. World War II changed the culture in America to a large degree because a lot of African Americans for the first time had good paying jobs because of the war and factories. A lot of them moved to the urban locations from rural locations because of the job demand. And so retailers started waking up, you know, to the idea that, hey, there's money to be made by actually appealing to a black audience for the first time in the United States. So WLAC realized that there was money to be made. And that's the thing I've always said about America's always been caught in this kind of three-way pull between institutionalized racism, which is a part of our history from the very beginning, unfortunately, these liberal crazy ideas of all men are created equal, and money. And the thing is that sometimes money can kind of overcome the racism. And this was a case of where to a certain degree it did. Like I said, they woke up and realized, wait, maybe we're racist, but there's money to be made. So we'll just put that to the side for a little while, you know.
Also known as exploitation.
Right. What happened is WLAC began scheduling, but, you know, at the time they were still referred to as race records for their nighttime programming. And at that time, if you lived anywhere other than in the big cities like LA or Chicago or New York, the music that you would hear that you might hear on the radio was pop music. You might hear some classical music. You might hear some hillbilly music. You would not hear R&B music. It just was not broadcast on the radio other than in really major and tended to be more northern or western urban centers. So when WLAC started scheduling this music at night in the South and on a station that you could hear over the entire eastern part of the United States, this was a major, major change culturally. Well, naturally, not only did African Americans begin tuning into WLAC to listen, there was another segment of the population, and that was white teenagers who had never, ever in their entire lives heard anything like this on the radio. And it's up-tempo, it's catchy, it's got that forbidden fruit quality to it that your parents hate, which of course has always appealed to teenagers. So WLAC pretty quickly became a sensation and inspired dozens of other radio stations to start playing R&B, programming R&B music at night. Well, early on, LAC was looking for broadcasters that this would appeal to. And one of the very first people that they picked up as, advertisers, they were looking for advertisers to sponsor this programming. And one of the very first ones they picked up was a shop here in Nashville called Buckley's Record Shop. Now, eventually he would be joined by Randy's Record Shop in Gallatin, Tennessee, and Ernie's Record Mart in here in Nashville. And Ernie's Record Mart would eventually start Excello and Nashville Records, which would specialize in R&B. Randy's Record Shop up in Gallatin would eventually start Dot Records, which would start off producing R&B records, but eventually when they found Pat Boone, you know, it was they found another cash cow, so they went in a different direction. But Buckley's kind of took a different route. He never really got into the record business. And all three of these shops would advertise on WLAC, and they would sell records through the mail. And this proved to be enormously popular because, and this was another reason, most of the record stores at that time, again, tended to carry pop music or classical music or maybe hillbilly music, but they didn't tend to carry R&B records. So here's all these people that are loving this music. They want a copy of it of their very own, and they can't buy it at their local store, or if they live in a rural area, there's no record stores at all. So that's why all three of these shops became enormously successful at selling records through the mail. Well, as I said, even though they all sold through the mail, Ernie's and Randy's both got into making records. So that was kind of their sideline. Well, Buckley's decided to go in a different route. Instead of, even though he was making a lot of money through mail records, he decided to concentrate on his retail business here in Nashville. And over the next decade, from 1940s when he begins broadcast advertising on WLAC up until the 50s, he ended up becoming pretty much the largest record retailer here in Nashville. Ernie's and Randy's both did more mail order, but Buckley's was selling the records to people who came through the door. So that became their big forte.
So did Buckley's start as just mail order?
Well, actually, like a lot of the early record stores began as a spinoff from people who owned jukeboxes. Buckley actually began his career in the record business in 1929 when he bought 10 jukeboxes that were located in bars and in speakeasies and easies and brothels that were around the Capitol back in the days where the road that went around the Capitol was pretty much all brothels. And what happened is that when you run jukeboxes, you end up with a lot of used records because you're having to put new records in there every few weeks. So you end up with a lot of old records. Well, what would happen is a lot of jukebox operators would end up opening up small shops to kind of sell off the used records. Eventually, though, if you've got a shop selling used records, people are going to come in there wanting to buy new ones, too. So then it makes sense to expand into new records. So anyway, that's how Buckley's became a record dealer, was that. He opened his first actual store in 1935 on 8th Avenue. And that may have been the actual first dedicated record store in Nashville. Because what happened is that in the 1920s, when most records were sold by furniture stores, because that's where you would buy Victrolas, because they were these enormous pieces. They were a piece of furniture, basically. There wasn't really record stores until around the 1930s, because before that, you'd go to the furniture store where you bought your Victrola to buy records for your Victrola. So anyway, Buckley's opens his first store in 35. He starts advertising on WLAC in 1945. By 1947, he opens a store on Union Street because he's needing more space to actually stock the records. And then in 1953, he decided to expand again, and that's when he opened up Buckley's Record Store on Church Street. And for the next 10 years, that would be his primary location of Buckley. And it really becomes the biggest, most successful record store in town. You want to hear some more history on Buckley's?
Yeah, as much as you got.
And, well, by 1962, Buckley's, as I said, was the largest retailer in town. And he struck upon an idea of a way he could have expanded was, at the time, Church Street in downtown, of course, he was kind of out of downtown. He was in Midtown, really, where the store was located. But Church Street in downtown Nashville at that time was like the retail center of Nashville. That's where all the big department stores were located. And one of the biggest ones in Nashville was Harvey's Department Store, which had originally opened in, I believe, 42. It occupied an entire block of Church Street between 5th and 6th Avenues. It had a fancy diner in it that for a while was called the Monkey Diner because they had live monkeys in cages.
I'm thinking, like, when did the Food and Drug Administration start? Because that's a clear violation.
Having monkeys located right above where you're eating is not a good idea.
No.
Anyway, in 62, he gets this idea. He approaches Fred Harvey at Harvey's Department Store and says, "Hey, I got a deal for you. I'm doing gangbusters on records. You're just doing okay here. Why don't I take over the record department of Harvey's? And I'll just pay you a commission on everything I sell, but I'll take care of all the expense. All you got to do is give me the space in your store to do it." And Harvey signs this deal with Buckley's at that point. Well, Buckley moves in, totally renovates the record department at Harvey's, opens it up as this just fabulous new thing, advertises it. It opened up on the ground floor on the 5th Avenue corner of Harvey's, and it had 2,000 square feet of retail space. And when they opened, they were stocking over 10,000 singles and nearly 7,000 LPs. So it was the largest record store in Nashville at that, And they had a 10-day grand opening where they had appearances by country stars and pop stars, and they were doing live broadcasts from the store on WLAC. And the thing just took off. It was a huge success. And what's really funny is that Grant's Department Store, which was right across the street from Buckley's, his big thing was that he would sell records at a discount. So he's at the time, brand new LPs listed for $3.98 and singles listed for 89 cents. Well, Buckley's actually cut his prices for a while. He was selling records at the Harvey's location for $1.99 a piece, basically half off. Well, Grant's and him got into a price war in 1962, shortly after this Harvey's location opened. And it became such a big deal, it was actually covered in Billboard magazine, on the front page of Billboard for a couple of months. It was like they kept cutting the prices on records until they were almost basically giving them away, just trying to get people to come into the store. And like I said, it tells you something that, you know, this was two department stores in Nashville, and yet it was on the front page of Billboard, you know. The Harvey's thing turned out to be a great deal because he opens the place in late 1962. And what happens about a year and a half later? The Beatles hit America. So record sales were already popular with kids, but of course, when the British invasion hit, you know, it was like Buckley was practically printing money between the store on Church Street, between the store at Harvey's, and then I believe in 1963, he took over the music department of the Harvey's store at Madison Square, too. And I remember when I was researching this, the thought hit me, like, I wonder how many Beatles records that were sold in Nashville probably were bought from Buckley's. It would be interesting to find out, because I'd be willing to bet probably the vast majority of them were.
It sounds like it with that big of a space. I mean, the two stores in a 2,000 square foot space and then an additional satellite store in Madison, I would imagine a lot.
Yeah, and I even have a few records in my collection that I've picked up here over the years that have a stamp, because Buckley's would stamp their albums on the back that it came from Buckley's.
No
And
way.
I have a few in my collection that have Buckley store stamps on them.
Do you remember what they are, what records they are?
Oh, well, I know one of them's a movie soundtrack, that because I'm still a nerd. I still like movie soundtracks. But it's a movie soundtrack to a Vincent Price movie from, I believe, 62 that I've got that has a Buckley stamp. And when I found it, it was just like, oh, this is so cool.
You know? So cool. So now he has two shops downtown.
Right. He opens the shop on Broadway in 66. And again, that shop focused primarily on country because of the location close to the Grand Ole Opry. They had a lot of in-store events with artists at that time. The Nashville Library in their photo archives, in the Metro archives, actually has a picture after picture of all these different live events at Buckley's. And a few years ago, when I wrote a story about Buckley's for the East Nashvillian, we went down to the library and pulled some photos. And my favorite one, we ended up running it in the magazine, and it's online on the East Nashvillian's website, of some in-store event, and there's all these adults standing there. And there's this one girl who probably looks to be maybe 12 or 13 standing in front of the group. And, you know, in the background, you see all these country albums on the wall. But that 13-year-old girl is holding up a copy of the Rolling Stones Flowers LP. It is like, forget all these country guys. Give me the Stones, you know. Anyway, so Buckley's opens in 1966. Well, in 67, his contract with Harvey's ended. And naturally, he tried to renew it. But Harvey's had realized, it's like, wow, we made a mistake when we gave this guy this sweet deal on the store. So basically what happened was Harvey's ended their contract and decided, no, we're going to take back over the record department. You know, we threw that money away by mistake. We're not going to make that mistake again. So at that point, Buckley's was cut back to the Broadway store and the store on Church Street. And because the Broadway store was new, he was concentrating on that. Well, a year later in 1968, another thing happens, and that is construction begins on the west side loop of the interstate loop, which was going to cut straight through Church Street and, Charlotte and Church and Broadway and Demumbrian. And so basically what happened is that you have this period from 1968 until the interstate opens in 1972. It opened on March 3rd, 72. From late 68 to 72, that whole side of that gulf there between downtown Nashville and midtown Nashville was cut off. All of the businesses on that time suffered naturally because, you know, it was like, instead of it being very simple to get from downtown Nashville to that area, it became, you know, a task to get there because you had to take different routes around to get there. And that whole area kind of fell on hard times, which would last all the way up through the 90s, you know. And so it never really fully recovered from that.
The interstate Randy is talking about is I-40. Hop on in Nashville going west, and you can take it all the way to California. Take it east, and it will get you right to the Atlantic Ocean, give or take about 20 miles. According to Tennessee historian Bill Carey, prior to I-40 being built, the now three-hour drive from Nashville to Knoxville would have taken about 10, over hills and hollers and through many, many, many small Tennessee towns. The original plan for the Nashville section of I-40 had it close to an area significantly more north of downtown, a white, well-off, more suburban area, close to Belle Meade, for those of you who are familiar with the different parts of town. The reconfigured plan, drawn up in relative secret in the mid-1950s and then buried in the County Planning Division office files, was to have it be much closer to the bustling downtown business and shopping area, but effectively cutting off the downtown access of several main thoroughfares, including Church Street and Jefferson Street. Jefferson Street is located in North Nashville. It's the area of town where the free black population began to congregate before the Civil War, and where the population experienced explosive growth after. In 1866, just a few years after the Emancipation Proclamation, Fisk University was founded right off Jefferson Street and became an elite beacon of black higher education. Eventually, two other black universities followed, Meharry Medical College and the Tennessee Agriculture and Industrial State University, now Tennessee State University. And the area became a destination for black students, educators, and medical professionals. The commerce and culture built on and near Jefferson Street between 1900 and 1950 cemented North Nashville as the center of the city's African-American community. It was the area of town where black people lived, shopped, ate, and entertained, since they weren't welcome to do so in the other areas where Jim Crow segregation was enforced. And on a Monday, I'm gonna love you. And on a Tuesday, I'm gonna hug you. And on a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, gonna love you. In the 40s, 50s, and 60s, Jefferson Street also had a thriving music scene. The list of musicians who played clubs like Maceo's and Club Del Morocco is amazing. Duke Ellington, Etta James, Little Richard, Jimi Hendrix, Ray Charles. I mean, it goes on and on. If you find yourself in Nashville, make sure to visit the Jefferson Street Sound Museum to learn more about how the Jefferson Street music scene specifically helped shape Nashville into the music city it is today. Jefferson Street was also the epicenter of the civil rights movement. Students who attended the three black universities in the area gave rise to the Nashville student movement. Recent Presidential Medal of Freedom recipient Diane Nash, along with Congressman John Lewis, Bernard Lafayette, C.T. Vivian, Rip Patton, and others, all converged in the places on or near Jefferson Street to be taught nonviolent protest techniques by the Reverend James Lawson. It was here they planned the Nashville sit-ins that led to the desegregation of the downtown lunch counters and stores. Many of the leaders Lawson trained during this time went on to establish the Freedom Rides that desegregated interstate bus travel throughout the South. The history, planning, and construction of the Nashville section of I-40 is rife with secrets, lies, exploitation, racism, and unkept promises. It started during the 50s when city leaders used the federal government funding for quote-unquote urban renewal to destroy many of the black-owned businesses that were just south of Jefferson Street, near Capitol Hill, in downtown Nashville. In 1958, a plan to have the interstate run straight through Jefferson Street, slashing it in half and destroying the vibrant business and cultural district, was filed away in the county courthouse. This plan was not revealed until 1968. In between, developers started using scare tactics to get Jefferson Street business owners to sell. And the Tennessee state government started buying up the land that they needed to build. When this started happening in the 60s, it tipped off community leaders, and they began to ask questions. In 1967, a citizen-led group calling themselves the I-40 Steering Committee began a legal battle against the proposed location, stating the obvious. The road would stop people from walking or driving to the businesses on Jefferson. It would isolate and financially devastate the community. They said what we now know to be true, what we now know to be actual policy, that local and state leaders and highway officials were being racially discriminatory in their planning. Of course, state attorneys denied the charges of racism. They argued in court that the proposed route had been on public file for 10 years and that there was no alternative route possible. They said that the amount of damage was exaggerated. All lies. But one judge after another ruled in favor of the state. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed that maybe the community could have been notified in a more timely manner, but that there was, quote, no way to prove that the plan was decided with racial intent. The United States Supreme Court refused to hear the case. And so, in 1968, the state of Tennessee resumed work on the interstate. Within a year, many of the Jefferson Street businesses would close and a majority would suffer catastrophic financial losses. Housing values plummeted and more than 1,000 Black residents would be displaced. And then, of course, no surprise, the promised relocation, compensation, and loan projects that would have assisted homeowners and businesses on Jefferson and surrounding streets like Church either failed or just never materialized. What I described here is a lot, but it's by no means a comprehensive retelling of this story. So many twists and turns, so many bad decisions, so much institutional racism. The use of urban planning as a tool for white supremacy did not start and end with the construction of our interstates. Official real estate covenants and exclusionary zoning policies and redlining, all wrapped up in a neat little Jim Crow bow, all contributed. In cities across America, Black communities were forced into small, under-resourced, and unequal areas that exist not by accident, but by racist local, state, and federal government top-down decision-making. In other words, by design. So what happened to Buckley's?
On September 22nd, 1973, a female clerk who had come in to open the store was in the store, and a guy broke into the store and ended up knifing her and killing her. And the store never reopened after that. And Buckley's decided to shut down the church store, Church Street store. So that's whenever that location of Buckley's ended. And that was the final blow. In the stories at the time, whenever he announced that they were going to close the store, he said, we're closing it because we've had problems there the last few years, and it's just not worth the loss of a life to try to continue to keep a store open in that location. He would continue to run the Broadway store up until 1976. By that point, he was getting old enough. He was wanting to retire. And also what had happened is that you had shopping malls now. So suddenly people weren't going downtown to buy records. Broadway had begun its decline too. It was pretty much, had kind of become Skid Row other than the tourist trade. And you had, at that point, you already had chains like Portocol and Katz opening up here in Nashville. And so there was all this competition from the shopping mall stores. So in 1976, Buckley decides to get out of the business. He closes the Broadway store, sells off the stock, sold off his personal record collection, which had records going all the way back to the 30s. And the Tennessean had some interesting stories at that time of like record collectors driving in from all over the country when his own personal collection went up for sale.
I'm gonna tell God how you treat me.
Thank you so much for listening. As I said, the stories I touched on in this episode are just the tip of a very large iceberg. If you want to learn more about Ernie's Record Mart or Randy's Record Shop or Buckley's, the radio stations and the DJs who played records no one else would, as well as a record label that recorded such greats as Lightning Slim and Slim Harpo, Roscoe Shelton, Marion James, and a spoken word sermon by Martin Luther King, grab yourself a copy of Randy's excellent book, Shake Your Hips, The Acceler Record Story. A link to buy the book can be found in the show notes and at lucysrecordshop.com. If you want to learn more about the students who desegregated the lunch counters and the stores in downtown Nashville in 1960, pick up David Halberstam's The Children. It's the definitive book on this piece of Nashville history and just a really fantastic read. And please go and visit the Jefferson Street Sound Museum in person if you are in Nashville or if you are visiting. Say hey to Lorenzo Washington if you can. But in the meantime, you can check it out at jeffersonstreetsound.com. If you're not in Nashville, you can hear the always captivating community radio station that grew out of the demise of WRVU at WXNAFM.org. The station does a tremendous job in reflecting the exciting musical and cultural diversity of what is Music City, USA. Lastly, for this episode, I relied heavily on the research done in two scholarly articles about the planning and construction of the Nashville section of I-40. So thank you to then-law student Campbell Haynes for writing 1 Mile North for the Belmont Law Review, and to Saber J. Rucker for writing The Highway to Segregation when he was at Vanderbilt. Links to these two pieces can be found in the show notes and at lucysrecordshop.com. And they're a great place to start if you want to dive into what happened back then and also know what's going on even right now in cities all across America. Also in the episode notes and at lucysrecordshop.com are links to some more of Randy's writing, as well as several playlists that feature music from the era that we covered in this episode. If you have any stories, pictures, or music you want to share about Lucy's or some other special community that you're a part of, send them along to at Lucy's Record Shop on Twitter, Instagram, and at the Lucy's Record Shop community on Facebook. You can also email me directly at mary@lucysrecordshop.com. You've probably noticed that I sound a little bit different on this episode. Major dental work will do that. And I might sound like this for a while, so there's really nothing I can do about it. And I apologize if it makes you as uncomfortable to listen to as it does me. But, this is awful. Thank you to Michael Eads for his time and the use of his studio, and to Lamb Chop for the music used in the intro. This show is part of We Own This Town, a podcast network of original entertainment and documentary content. You can find more info at the official site at weownthistown.net or follow at We Own This Town on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Thanks for listening, and until next time.
Listen to them.